Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I am with Kit. I'm always happy when I'm with Kit. He always brightens my day. But Kit, who have we got on today?
We have got a treat for you. We've got Marco Perali. He is a historian and academic who specialises in Greek literature on papyrus and papyri, especially Greek poetry. And he is here to talk to us all about papyrus.
Can you hear the excitement in Kit's voice? Marco, welcome. Kit is overly excited. I'm excited.
And thank you. I'm excited too.
I'm going to let Kit kick off because he's just way too happy and I can't ruin this happiness streak for him.
Well, let's start with the most obvious question, because we've all heard of papyrus. What is papyrus and what is papyrology?
So papyrology, it's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? It's a compound word in English, right? It has two members. So the first is papyrus, which is a Greek word, papyrus. And the second element of that compound is logos. If you know a little bit of Greek, logos means reason, study. So the suffix logia in Greek means discipline or the scientific, the academic study of papyri. So I guess the following question is, what is a papyrus, right? So papyrus is essentially a piece of paper, a writing support, which is actually not made out of paper. So it's actually derived from a plant, and it's an aquatic plant, which was particularly common in Egypt, in the ancient world. So papyri were widely used as a writing support. They were used to write basically anything on it, from private letters to, you know, official correspondence to, you name it, shopping lists, contracts, census declarations, all sorts of kind of expressions of everyday life, really, in ancient Egypt. And also books, which is what interests me the most. So, As papyrologists, we deal with actually two different formats of papyri. So probably the most common is the roll, is a roll of papyrus. The roll, which could be several meters long, was made of rectangular sections of bits of papyrus kind of glued horizontally one after the other. It could be up to, well, several meters long. Well, you had to kind of roll it up, you know, you made it portable so you can carry it with you. You could consult it, for example, at libraries, in your personal library, in a private library or in a public library or at school. And obviously you had to unroll it, right, in order to read the content of that papyrus. So you will, you unroll it with your right hand while holding the left extremity of the papyrus with your left hand. And the other important format that was used in antiquity, especially from the second century AD onwards, is the codex. This is a Latin word, actually, which is basically a book made of multiple foldable sheets stitched together in the middle, just like, you know, modern books in paperback format. And actually, if you look at the spine of a book, of a modern book, you will see the so-called signatures, right? So the stacks of pieces of paper, which are folded and grouped together. It was basically the same format. And then this is a little bit unintuitive, but papyrologists also deal with parchments. And parchments are manuscripts that were not made out of papyrus. They were made out of the skin of an animal. A calf, a goat as well, a sheep sometimes, obviously had to clean it up first and turn it into a surface that it was smooth enough to receive writing, right? And we also deal with potsherds, wooden tablets, leather, metal, even bones sometimes, or linen, basically anything that had writing on it, except inscriptions on stone. We don't do those. This is the realm of epigraphists. And coins, so legends of coins. This is what numismatists, so the experts in numismatics, do. And something that I want to make clear, we're not exactly archaeologists either, in the sense that we don't necessarily travel to Egypt and, you know, dig out that material, so we don't excavate. Well, some of us, I guess, do lead some excavation campaigns. We may be called maybe to assess some aspect of an expedition, of a campaign related to papyri, but we are actually handed down the material by archaeologists, and we look at it, and we try to decipher its content. And I say we try because it's not a straightforward process at all. It's a process that can take years and years and years just to, you know, read and decipher a text of one column. It happened to me certainly multiple times.
Well, let's dive into that, because obviously there's several challenges there. I imagine papyrus has been around before the word papyrus, because that's obviously Greek. You were talking about the ancient Egyptians. When is the first sort of documents emerging using this plant from the Nile?
So papyri were already used in Egypt around 5,000 years ago. So they were written in a form, like different forms of ancient Egyptian, actually. There were two types of writing systems back then. One is called hieroglyphic. You may have heard of it. It was used for religious literature. And the other one is called hieratic, which was used by essentially priests. It's just some form of abridged hieroglyphic system that was used not only for religious purposes, but also for administrative stuff. There was also a third Egyptian script called Demotic that developed roughly in the 7th century BC and was used for more than 1,000 years, up to, let's say, the 5th century AD. These three writing systems are deciphered by Egyptologists. So this is actually not what I do. I can't read any of those. So the Egyptologists study the culture, the history, the language, the literature written in those three languages. My field of research is the Greco-Roman world. In particular, papyri written in Egypt during the Ptolemaic Empire. So that's after Alexander the Great and during the Roman Empire until the Arab conquest of Egypt in the 7th century AD. I guess a question from you or from your listeners may be at this point, so if you can read Greek and if you decipher Greek, why did they speak Greek in Egypt back then, right? And the question has to do with Alexander the Great, because Alexander was a Greek. He was a northerner, a Macedonian, to be precise. And he subdued, as you know, he subdued Egypt in 332 BC. And when his kingdom was divided up into reigns, these are the so-called reigns of the Diadochoi in Greek. It would be the successors in English. Egypt was assigned to one of his generals, whose name was Ptolemy. And he is the initiator of the Ptolemaic dynasty. Ptolemy the First. He had, a nickname called the Soter, which means the savior. Very pretentious nickname. And he ascended the throne shortly after Alexander died in 323. And he was the one who essentially opened Egypt to Hellenism. To be sure, some contact with the Greek world had existed before. I'm thinking of, for example, the city of Memphis, where there was already a Greek community before Alexander the Great, or Naucratis, where it was a Greek city founded centuries earlier in the Delta of the Nile. So there were examples of communities who succeeded in maintaining their purely Greek character among the Egyptians. But the rest of Egypt had remained thoroughly Egyptian. So they had the language, the cults, the traditions that kind of passed from generation to generation during the reigns of the pharaohs. And Alexander and Ptolemy inherited all of that. And Egypt continued to be Egyptian throughout the centuries, despite a long period of Persian domination in the late 6th and 5th century. That would be the first Egyptian satrapy. And also there was a brief kind of decade of Persian domination right before Alexander's conquest. That would be the second Egyptian satrapy.
Well, let's talk about your specialty, though, because if people know anything about the Ptolemaic dynasty, it's probably one of two things. One is Cleopatra. I think everyone's heard of Cleopatra. That's a descendant. The second thing is that Ptolemy had a great library. So I'm guessing there's loads and loads of papyri that you can dive into.
Yeah. The issue of the Library of Alexandria is also kind of connected with Alexander. And because after the Macedonian conquest, so the face and the character of Egypt changed quite dramatically in a very short time. So you have to imagine, like, people coming from all parts of the Hellenic world, they move in, and they not, obviously, to Alexandria, that was the largest center and was the foundation of Alexander the Great. And it soon became the greatest of all the Greek cities, but they moved to the entire country, really. And they first subdued the native population. So you have this very kind of elite presence in Alexandria. And part of this elite presence is due to a project initially Ptolemy the first, but also his son Ptolemy the second, who essentially invested a lot of money into the foundation of not only the library, but also a research center called the Museum in Alexandria. Probably the idea was given to him by an Athenian called Demetrius in the late 4th century. And Demetrius was in contact with Aristotle, the famous philosopher who kind of was responsible for the systematization of all the Greek, learning and information of all kinds. But what Ptolemy II did was essentially invite and obviously pay for them, for the salaries and everything. He invited scholars and scientists to Alexandria. And these scholars, the first two of them, Philetus and Zenodotus, they also acted as tutors for the son of the king. So the son of the king, Ptolemy the first, so that's Ptolemy the second, the Philadelphus, was taught by the top kind of scholars available at that time, Philetus and Zenodotus. And probably around the 280s, they started building the library. And yeah, the quantity of rolls that they managed to get was incredible. There was actually a scholar recently that tried to calculate the number of rolls available in the library, because there is a kind of a mismatch between what the ancient sources say. They tend to kind of exaggerate, the number a little bit. Let's say 400,000 or 700,000. And this scholar, who is R.S. Bagnall, reached the conclusion that probably we were talking about maybe 10,000 or 15,000, which is still an incredible, number of rolls. And one roll, we said it could be several meters long. Normally, one roll would be enough to contain the text of either a Greek tragedy, so that's 1,500 lines, or three books of Homer, which is again around, it varies. Well, let's say between 1,500 and 2,000. And also with prose, you could contain. So when we say, for example, the first book of Thucydides or the first book of Herodotus, we mean the quantity of text that was needed to fill in a papyrus roll.
I did not know that. And now that completely and utterly makes sense. Thank you for, for making me understand that. I sat at university and I was thinking, why is this? These books are so tiny. Why have they been broken up into such tiny? You could just make it one. Okay, now it makes sense. I have a question that I was supposed to get us back on track, but I've decided not to because I've thought of something else. So we had a different historian come on board who wrote a book on Alexandria, and he said that when ships would port at Alexandria, they wouldn't search the ship for contraband. They search it for books and for papyri, and they basically confiscate that and just stick it into the library.
Yeah, it probably happened in some way or another. I mean, this is some sort of anecdote that Galen actually reports. So the ancient doctor Galen.
I've just shot up because Galen is like the foundation of medieval medicine, essentially.
Exactly. So in a preface to one of his books, he mentions this anecdote. And he says that, you know, the king was so adamant in getting, you know, all the, especially from Athens, obviously, because Athens was still, you know, the most important center in terms of culture and literature. And he was particularly interested, apparently, you know, judging from what Galen says, interested in the text of the tragedies of Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides, which were written about 150 years before. And yeah, he wanted to get the originals of those papyri. So what he would do is he would kind of set up some kind of atelier, you know, get some scribes and copyists, copy the original text, preserve the original copies, and send back to the Athenians the copies. So preserve the original Athenian material and ship back to Athens the copies. And this is what Galen says. You know, we don't know whether that ever happened, but it tells us something about the attitude of the new kings towards knowledge. They wanted to become, you know, they wanted Alexandria and Egypt to become the new Athens.
It's fascinating, and I could talk to you for a very long time about all of this, but we're here to talk about your discipline as well. So let's talk about papyrology. When did it really start? How did it start? And what have been the most important discoveries in the field?
Yeah, so papyrology is a relatively new discipline in the sense that it developed with the excavations of papyri carried out by, well, the Brits, and the Germans, the Austrians, towards the end of the 19th century. But the first Greek papyrus from Egypt that was known in Europe was bought way earlier than that, in 1777, by an anonymous Italian merchant in Giza, in Egypt. And it was actually donated to a cardinal in Italy called Stefano Borgia, who kept it at its own museum in Velletri. And then what this cardinal does, he basically contacts a professor, a Danish academic, who was able to decipher the content of that papyrus and find out what it is. And this is actually a fairly recurring aspect of early papyrology. You know, the fact that papyri were acquired in Egypt on the market. I was going to say black market, but, you know, it's not really the... It's not really the correct way of calling a market that had no restrictions whatsoever. So, you know, you just didn't worry about, you know, the provenance of the artifacts, who sold that papyrus to you. These are kind of modern concepts. So it was, they were just acquired in Egypt on the market by private individuals. And this is material that is, yeah, essentially looted, right? From an ancient site and sold to the world, to the wealthiest buyer. So that particular papyrus in particular turned out to be a text that perhaps from my perspective, I'm a literary papyrologist, so I'm interested mostly in, you know, books and literary products. That papyrus turned out to be a list of inhabitants of a village in Egypt who had to work on the maintenance of the channels of the Nile and the dike. And it's a Roman text. It was dated to 193 AD. So, but you know, I'm not diminishing the importance of a document of that kind. You know, it's still important for those historians who study the history of Egypt. Because what I wanted to make clear is that there are two aspects of our disciplines. There is the study of the ancient documents from papyri and the study of ancient literature from papyri. So we have, these are two different branches of the discipline. And we called the study of documents, documentary papyrology, and the study of literature, literary papyrology. And I do mostly literature. So, but anyway, I digress. But what is important about the history of the discipline is that we understand the origin of these artifacts and how they were kind of brought to Europe. So we're at the end of the 18th century. There is Napoleon, the Napoleonic army that occupies Egypt between 1798 and 1801. And in his expedition, Napoleon brings along a large group of scholars tasked with studying the different aspects of ancient and modern Egypt and kind of document, you know, the things that they see. You may have heard of this famous book called La Description de l'Égypte, so the description of Egypt. So that is basically the report by a corps of 167, I think it was, technical experts called the savants in French. So the experts known as the Commission de Science et des Arts. And they accompanied the French army to Egypt. And I guess the description of Egypt, the book, that book was key because it kind of gave a further input, like an incentive almost to continue the research on Egypt, including the decipherment of the Egyptian script by Champollion, who happened in 1822.
Because this is where we get the Rosetta Stone, isn't it? This is where we start to understand all of this stuff.
Exactly. So to put things in context, the Rosetta Stone, so this decree issued in Memphis by one of the Ptolemies, that was Ptolemy V, in three languages, hieroglyphic, Demotic, and Greek, which allowed us to understand hieroglyphics by comparing it with the Greek. That was found in 1799. So it's precisely those years that we're talking about. So it was this kind of political change that Napoleon brought about in Egypt that made it easier for Europeans to, well, first of all, visit Egypt, but also purchase material in Egypt. And you had this kind of transfer of Egyptian antiquities to Europe that intensifies kind of progressively. So at the beginning, papyri were actually part of this kind of wealth of antiquities that was leaving Egypt with no control whatsoever. We would be horrified by, you know, those kind of dynamics, but, you know, we're living in a different world today. And it took, I guess, nearly a century for the discipline to grow and be established as a, I would say maybe a sub-discipline of classics and ancient history. And it took nearly 100 years for the value and the specificity of those papyri to be recognized. I'm not even sure whether I should call those kind of proto-papyrologists as scholars because, you know, those savants, right, who were part of the Napoleonic expeditions. I mean, some of those were just antiquarians, really. For example, there was one called Bernardino Drovetti, who was appointed by Napoleon as French consul to Egypt. And he acquired some of the papyri that were later acquired by kingdoms like, for example, Charles Felix of Sardinia. So he was the king of the reign of Piedmont Sardinia. And that actually collection, well, that core of papyri became the core of the collection in Turin, in the Museo Egizio, in the Egyptian Museum in Turin. So basically, yeah, this is the way collections in Europe were formed. We mentioned Turin, but we should also mention various libraries in Europe, the British Museum in London, So the Bibliothèque Nationale and the Louvre in Paris, the Staatliche Museum in Berlin, the Rijksmuseum in Leiden. So these are all collections that still have papyri, and quite a lot, actually, we're talking about.
Yeah, it's funny you mention it, because I've just been looking at the Leiden papyri because it's really important for alchemy and sort of the links to it. But let's talk about the modern idea of a papyrologist, because you're saying that these past antiquarians, they weren't really papyrologists. How do you train to be a papyrologist? What do you do and what do you learn?
Yeah, so I guess things really change at the end of the 19th century when they, you know, people start excavating in Egypt. There are two major, well, maybe three major figures that kind of made possible the development of the discipline in that kind of scholarly direction. One is probably Flinders Petrie, who went to excavate in Egypt at the end of the 19th century. And there is actually a museum in London, which is called the Petrie Museum, where you can go and see what he actually found and know about his career. He ended up being probably the first professor. He wasn't called professor of papyrology. He was still called professor of Egyptology back then, talking about 1892, if I'm correct. But he was the person who got in contact with two, let's say, philologists from Queen's College, Oxford, Bernard Grenfell and Arthur Hunt. They were philologists. They knew Greek very well. They went to excavate with Petrie first at different locations in Egypt, and then they ended up without Petrie in a city called Oxyrhynchus, which is down south, is far away from Cairo. And they conducted six excavation campaigns between 1897 and 1906. And they found a lot of papyri in that city, a lot. And by a lot, I mean, they were able to bring back to Oxford around 500,000 fragments. And we're still sifting through that material. We have managed to publish 5,500, roughly, in how many, 100 years, or probably more than that. So there is a lot of work to do. I'm not part of the Oxyrhynchus team, but I'm an associate of the Oxyrhynchus team, and I'm actually deciphering some of those myself at the moment. And how do you train to be a papyrologist? How do you read that material? Well, my experience was I trained as a classicist, first of all. So I studied Greek and Latin in secondary school in Italy. And then I moved to the UK first as a visiting scholar, and I learned the basics of the discipline of papyrology at Oxford, first as a visiting student, as I said, and then I went to work there as a postdoc. And so you first need to acquire a solid knowledge of the language. And by the language, I mean the poetic language and also the prose. Because, as we said earlier on, when you get a papyrus, it could be anything. So it could be prose, could be historiography, could be a tragedy, it could be a comedy, it could be a shopping list. I mean, we have one in Liverpool in which you literally have items of stuff that person in Egypt had to buy, to kind of one is a lettuce and the other one is a spoon or whatever, and so you need to be familiar with, different kind of layers of Greek and different registers of Greek, colloquial Greek, but also literary Greek. And then you train as a papyrologist. So you try to decipher the handwriting. And obviously there were different handwriting styles. People would use different handwritings depending on the text that they were going to copy or write out. But you would do the same in, today, I guess, if you're writing a note to your mom, well, you would probably type it nowadays on your phone. But, until maybe 10 or 20 years, 20 years ago, you would still write a note and send it to her. And, and, And that note, probably if someone in, I don't know, 2500 AD finds that note and tries to decipher it, and that note is in English, and that person is not living in Britain or the US, you know, he would have trouble identifying that message. And, you know, it's basically the same for us. So you need to be trained.
Something. Sorry, yeah. you've brought about some sort of trauma in me right now. So I'm assuming everybody here who has sat in the archives feels exactly the same way as I'm going to feel right now. Meaning, if you go and you found some really interesting, I don't know, a file, and in it it's handwritten, and you can't read it because the person writes like a bloody doctor, and you're sitting there and you're going, even though you're well versed in the language, and you're sitting there, you're going, what the hell is this? I mean, the frustration in it, and you're having to get someone who, for example, is a specialist in reading, I don't know, someone who's got really stupid handwriting from, I don't know, the 1930s and 40s, and having to get them to suffer it. So my great grandfather is a prime example of this. He's written his diaries of a really important era in the beginning of the Second World War. He talks about the defense of Lvov. However, nobody can frigging read it because it's like chicken scratchings.
Yeah, I know the feeling totally. I mean, it's this is why I said earlier on that, you know, sometimes it takes years to actually read, say, 20 lines of something. And then there is the added difficulty of the conditions of that papyrus sheet or roll or codex or whatever. The bloody thing has holes in it, holes all over it. And the ink sometimes is kind of worn out. I mean, sometimes it's readable, sometimes it's not. So part of our job is actually to fill in those gaps in the text. And basically, yeah, you have to use your imagination. And maybe you compare that sentence with another sentence that you found in a separate author. Sometimes the language is very formulaic, so you can actually expect what that person is going to say, especially if it's an official document, for example.
So this is the day job, but you're always looking for those nuggets of goodness. You know, you're hoping that it's something really exciting that you're reading. So talk us, what's the coolest thing that you've had set in front of you and you've got to decipher?
That's a good question. I've published maybe dozens of papyri by now. And, well, as I said, literature, poetry is what interests me the most. So I always, you know, when I am given a new papyrus, I'm always hoping that I'm finding the new Callimachus or the new bit of the Catalogue of Women of Hesiod. These are all, you know, ancient works that were lost, but we can kind of reconstruct through papyri. And when I mean reconstruct through papyri, when I say reconstruct through papyri, I mean through fragments of papyri. So it's very uncommon to find an entire roll that is intact and preserved, let's say 20, you know, columns of a treatise or an ancient tragedy. So I would say, my hope is to find something that is lost. With papyri, you never know. Sometimes you just bump into a bit of Homer, and that's not really exciting. Why? Because we already have the text of Homer. We have the entirety of it. We have the entirety of the Iliad and the Odyssey. So in that case, it's pretty easy to kind of supply the missing bits. But what if you come across a bit of a Greek tragedy by Aeschylus that has been lost? I mean, that's a completely different level of importance and relevance, right? So, and a lot of fragments of ancient tragedians were actually found in the last, say, two centuries. Because when it comes to, for example, Greek tragedy,
quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you go to a library that is kind of decently equipped, you will find seven tragedies of Aeschylus. Well, maybe six, depends if you consider the Prometheus Bound authentic or not. But seven tragedies by Sophocles, 19 tragedies by Euripides. But we know from ancient sources that Aeschylus wrote over 70 tragedies, that Sophocles wrote over 120 tragedies, and around 90 by Euripides. So we only have a fraction of what they wrote. So finding a new bit of a Euripides would be nice. In terms of my own experience, I just finished editing a papyrus that I don't really know what it is, to be honest. So it's clearly a piece of Greek lyric. It's written in a dialect that is a particular dialect of Greek, which is called Ionic, which was spoken and written in certain areas of the Greek world, the islands, for example, of Greece, and the coast of Asia Minor. And it's really difficult to find out what the content is, but I suspect, based on the metrical structure of the text and based on the dialect itself, that is a piece by the poet Anacreon. It's just that I cannot prove it, because the text that I've got in front of me of that papyrus doesn't match any bit of Anacreon that is already available to us. And we have, you know, nowadays we have the technology that enables us to find out whether a certain word that we find in a papyrus already occurs in an existing text. So we are able to establish whether the text that we have in front of us is a known text or an unknown text. In that case, it is an unknown text. It is a piece of Greek lyric, who knows by whom. It sounds like, you know, the style of it suggests an archaic author, and by archaic, I mean pre-classical, so between 800 BC to 500 BC. And I suspect it was a competent poet, a poet that was worth copying, if you know what I mean, on a bit of papyrus in a pretty beautiful handwriting. And that matters as well. But I just can't prove it. And that's frustrating.
But that's really exciting as well. And it's fascinating, because hearing you describe it, my first thought was the name of the rose and, you know, Aristotle's lost Bacchic comedy and everyone getting murdered for it and things like that. I'm assuming that doesn't happen in your discipline. And it's more like a jigsaw puzzle of you know, pieces that you're trying to hook together to find these lost poems.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a puzzle, but with missing bits, because the papyri is so often are in such a bad condition that you just play with what you have. And then sometimes it turns out that a bit of the same papyrus is preserved in a different collection somewhere else, because the papyrus comes from Egypt, comes from the same place, but it was sold maybe in the 19th century to different institutions. Obviously, it was more convenient, they were able to gain more money by dismembering a bit of papyrus and sell it to different people. And that happened to me quite often, you know, that a bit of the papyrus was in, let's say, Berlin, but another bit was in Florence. And
Is that scattering the main issue that we have with these ancient texts then? Or did we have civilizations that didn't consider them as important as we do today and they destroyed them or they just forgot about them? Did that happen as well?
That's a good question. It's also probably a difficult question to answer in the sense that when Grenfell and Hunt went to Oxford Incas and they were actually hoping to find different sort of material. They were looking into tombs and they couldn't find any of those nice kind of mummy wrappings. So bits of cartonnage papyri that will be very long texts. They actually went to excavate outside the city and they found papyri in the rubbish mounds of the ancient Roman city, scattered all around. You know, they weren't kind of deposited there on purpose. This is just how they found them. And sometimes you will find papyri inside ancient buildings. Some of the times, I'm thinking, for example, like the only available example of ancient library from the Greco-Roman world, Herculaneum. So in that case, the papyri were found inside a villa. So they call it the Villa of the Papyri, a house belonging to a politician, apparently, that had that was pretty intimate with Epicurean philosophy. And they found a lot of treatises by Epicurus in there.
So this is Herculaneum as in the Pompeii explosion.
Exactly. So, and those rolls, they actually found it carbonized, so burnt out, precisely because the Mount Vesuvius erupted in AD 79. So the collection belonged to someone who probably established the library, created the library in his own house, around maybe 40 BC. He was a pretty important chap, apparently the father-in-law of Caesar. I mean, it's not entirely clear. Yeah, and it's a total coincidence that we were actually able to retrieve that material, and that material is exclusively philosophical. So again, you see, we don't choose what we get to find. It's entirely down to chance. You were going to ask something, Alina.
Right. Okay. Sorry. I was trying to find the tablets that I was looking for. Right. So in Pompeii, they also found wax tablets in the excavation of Lucius. I can't pronounce his surname.
Alcornius?
Yes. Lundus. That's the one I was looking for. Oh. I knew I'd find it. So, because I studied Pompeii University. So for me, that was also really fascinating. So they didn't just find stuff. I mean, Herculaneum finds it absolutely incredible. I mean, it's fantastic. What they find, especially things like wood and things that have not been preserved in Pompeii, because obviously the eruption was different, blah, 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 blah. We don't talk about it. But they do find wax tablets. And this guy was not a tax collector, but he did basically accounting, I think, I can't remember what it was, but basically he had all of these receipts and everything else on these wax tablets, which is absolutely incredible. That's the only comment I wanted to make there. Sorry.
Yeah. It's pretty common to find, let's say, what we call documents as opposed to literary text in a collection or in an archaeological finding. So to give you an idea, the Oxyrhynchus collection in Oxford, 90% of the material is documents and 10% of the material is actually books or remains of ancient books. Wax tablets are part of papyrological collections, for certain. Probably the most kind of exciting discovery was found in terms of wax tablets were found in Vindolanda in Britain, actually. And that is private correspondence between soldiers and, well, other soldiers or, you know, members of the Roman administration. So that kind of everyday life sort of component of papyrology is indeed really interesting. And you find messages of, let's say, a student that has gone to Alexandria from a city in Egypt to study, and he sends a letter to his parents, you know, complaining about this teacher. That is a papyrus from Oxyrhynchus, which is pretty famous. You find examples of expressions of violence as well. You know, there were documents detailing sexual abuse among slaves, and heartbreaking stories sometimes, you know. But it's the everyday life of people, so it was not that different from what we are experiencing. And obviously a lot of people complaining about taxes.
It's been fascinating talking about this. So let's wrap it up. What is the future of papyrology? What is your work going on at the moment? And if people want to know a bit more, where can they go? Where can they find out stuff?
Yeah, so my own project is about anonymous poetry on papyri. So I'm now curating, I'm editing a collection of Greek hexameters. That's the meter that Homer used to write Epic, but you could also use that meter to write other things. And I am developing this project at the University of Barcelona. And I was lucky enough, you know, that this project was funded. So papyrologists tend to constantly apply for, you know, external, you know, funding opportunities.
We all do. That's just the nature of the beast.
Yeah. To just continue with the, you know, transcription of these documents. We said that there are thousands and thousands of documents that still lie kind of unexplored, unidentified, untranslated, because obviously part of our job is to translate, right, these texts to make them understandable to the public, not just to scholars. So we need new people that are willing to train to achieve that kind of, you know, language proficiency that is sufficient to transcribe and translate an ancient text. We need funding. We need funding that is necessary to keep the technological resources functioning. So we mentioned, for example, you know, databases of ancient Greek literature that we can use to identify the material. We need to have usable, computer facilities, but also websites. We need to have scanners that to scan images of the papyri, so we can kind of carry the pictures of the papyrus that we initially inspected in person on our computers, softwares to manipulate those images and make sure that the ink becomes maybe a little bit more visible than it is on the original. We need microscopes to actually, you know, improve the reading of the originals. And then all sorts of things. I mean, we need agreements with publishers to make publications of our editions open access, which is still relatively uncommon in the discipline of papyrology. So this is an attempt for me to, let's say, reach the wider public and talk about what we do and hopefully convey the importance of what we do for the study of the ancient world. In terms of where to find these resources, apart from website, for example, there is a website called papyri.info in which you have the Greek text and some translations of all the documents that have been discovered so far, which is pretty amazing. They are in a team in Heidelberg is in the process of creating the equivalent for literary texts as well. And then obviously there are specialized libraries that contain papyrological sections. There is an amazing library in London that is actually part of the University of London. And it's a kind of a separate independent, institute called the Institute of Classical Studies that has a library that's called the Hellenic and Roman Library. And the public can actually access those resources by simply becoming a member of the library by a small annual fee. If you're interested in this, you can contact me. I'm one of the trustee of this institution. And yeah, I think what we do is we need to make sure that papyrology is taught somewhere at university level. And that also is uncommon, unfortunately, in Britain at the moment. Oxford is obviously the place you go to because they have this huge collection and you can look at the material. You can inspect the originals and it's very exciting. Other universities, not so much.
Marco, this has been so interesting and I'm surprised we haven't done something like this so much earlier. And we've touched on Egypt, we've touched on Rome, we've touched on Greece. We've literally gone, well, I wouldn't say we've gone around the whole ancient world, but we've gone partially around the ancient world talking about papyri, which is so interesting. And Kit even added, we somehow brought in World War II, so, which is so true. We brought in every Asian aspect, because of course I had to bring in World War II. With my great-grandfather and his horrible, horrible handwriting. We've got to get you back to come and do something else because this has been absolutely excellent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure for me. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books. You can support them and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.